Hello and welcome to our weekly podcast of Who's Here in the Hamptons. I'm Dan Rettiner, your host, broadcasting from my home in the Hamptons, where I have lived for over 55 years. I've written a dozen books about this glorious place, and I've seen it grow through the years from small tourist towns, quaint fishing villages, and a summer playground for high society, to what it is today, a world-class resort for celebrities, artists, musicians, authors, and billionaires. In my podcast, I will bring you interviews with not only these people, but also prominent local people who have helped shape the Hamptons. Welcome to Dan's Talks. My guest today is Simon Van Boy, who is an author of now 10 books, and this one, the 11th, I think, coming out somewhere around that, and has built quite a following. And I think it's fair to say the work is fairly unusual. Most writing today seems to be all about speed and action and things happening, and it's not your style. It's you are much more of an internal kind of writer. What I've been reading in your new book is taking place between a woman and a mouse, which goes a whole book. But let's talk about that for a minute. What would you say about my comment about it? Is that about accurate?
I'd say that's what the story is. Friendship between somebody who's quite lonely, a lonely woman, and a stray animal who happens to be very small.
What what are you offering in your mind? Why is this an important way of looking at life? Not that it isn't. I'm just saying it's unusual. So I'm asking about that.
I suppose when I'm writing, it's quite self-indulgent, really, because I'm compelled by some emotion for someone or something. And in this case, it just happened to be my love for a couple of mice that I had recently, you know, during the pandemic. And I wanted to explore a story about, you know, how mice are just capable of giving love and receiving love. So I suppose when I'm writing a book, I'm not really thinking initially about, you know, I write on a typewriter. So I'm not thinking really about, will my editor like it? You know, will my publicist be able to work with this? I'm really thinking about how can I convey all this love knotted up, all these emotions knotted up in my heart? Because sometimes it's not love, it's regret or something like that. So I'm sort of untying these knots and putting them onto the page and then hoping later when Simon, the editor, sees the manuscript and is like, oh, bleep, what is this? You know, then Simon, the editor, will be able to actually rework it and do something with it so that it's not just about the author, but then it becomes about the reader. So the reader brings it alive by reading it in their own, for their own sort of emotional context.
So in that sense, it's sort of therapeutic.
Is that- for me, it is, yeah. And if I didn't make, if I didn't make a living from writing, I would still do it if nobody bought my books, which may happen at some point. it's fine. I don't mind. As long as I have some time in my life to do it, then it allows me to live and not be walking around like a character from a Leonard Cohen song in a raincoat, burdened by like all my emotional loads.
What got you interested in writing? Where are you from? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm from a village in Wales, North Wales, called Rhythyn, and in Clwyd. And I grew up there, you know, and it was a different type of childhood than today. For instance, you'd leave the house, you know, on a Saturday with maybe a tongue sandwich in one's pocket, and then just wander. And, you know, I'd go off into woods and I'd just sort of sit under a bush for a few hours, eat my sandwich, and then I'd maybe find a dead animal and look at it with a stick, and then go sit by a river. And then maybe I'd go over to my friend's house and his mother would tell me to get lost. So I'd go back into a field and like try and talk to cows. And then you would come home and, you know, that would be it. You'd watch telly. That was the highlight of the day. And then you'd go to bed. So it was unsupervised, and it was I'd meet all strange kinds of people, you know, the person who always has alcohol on their breath, the person who tells you you're going to hell unless you do this. You know, it was very much a Welsh village childhood.
What about school? I mean, how old are you when you were doing all this?
I was about 7 or 8. I mean, nowadays, saying to your 7 or 8 year old, okay, bye, have a lovely Saturday, you know, do whatever you want. I mean, that's unthinkable. But back in those days, you know, in the 80s, you would see children like 6, 7, 8 just wandering around by themselves. And I was recently, well, a few years ago, I was in Ireland for a book conference, and I went into an Indian restaurant, the only Indian restaurant in the town, and I was having lunch. And a couple of 7-year-old boys walked in, and I thought, oh, this is going to be interesting. And one of them nervously said to the waiter, we've come in to ask you what time it is. And the waiter said, oh, it's 2:30. And one of the boys says, oh, that's a grand time, 2:30. Mm. And they just sort of looked around, and then one of them said, smells good in here. It smells very nice. And, you know, they wanted lunch. And but they were just wandering around, like popping into shops, asking the time. So in parts of, you know, Ireland, at least, you still can have that childhood.
I see. And you came to America.
I did when I was about 17. I left the UK.
How'd that come about?
Well, I'd grown up on American television.
I see.
A-Team, Dallas, Knight Rider. It wasn't literary intentions. It was, I wanted to be actually in the NFL. I left school at 16 and I played rugby. And I got recruited to play American football at a college from rugby. And they said, you know, we'll give you a free college education. And that's not something I was going to do in the UK. I was just going to play sport. So I thought, well, that'll be interesting. And so I came, I always loved America. I worked when I was 16 as a dishwasher at a local, like a nearby US Army base, US Air Force base. And so a lot of my friends were in the Air Force, US Air Force. And I just thought they were really a good bunch of men. I really liked them. They were generous and open and eccentric and friendly. And so I thought I'll get along with the people here. And I did. And I came over, went to Kentucky, and played for a couple of years. And then in college, I was taking art and literature classes. You had to take all these various, you know, seminars. And I realized that I actually love art and literature more than anything in the world. And I'll give up all sport. And I want to just pursue art. It was like, I just couldn't believe this existed. Poetry existed. It was just the emotional core. And so then from then on, I just gave my life to art and literature.
I had a similar experience finding humor, but it's a whole different story in literature and television and so forth. But a question I did want to ask you, where were your parents in all this when you were in Wales? And what was that relationship in 10 words or less?
It was typical. My parents were, you know, always very supportive and loving, but they were very young when they had kids. I mean, in their early 20s. So, you know, you can only parent to the limit of your own experience and maturity. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I consider my childhood to be good, but it was definitely typical of the period. My parents' generation, I don't think they're not as emotionally, they don't indulge in the emotional sort of companionship that I would with my daughter.
I see. So you came here, and at some point you wound up in New York, and I know you came out east to the East End. Talk about that a little.
I left Kentucky, went back to the UK, studied art for a couple more years, just sort of bummed around reading poetry, reading Jack Kerouac, Ginsberg, Ted Jones, you know. And then I always had to make a living. So whether it was working in factories or fishing, or I found that you could teach English as a second language to Greek children and they would pay for everything and give you a small salary. So I went to Greece and did that. And then I thought, you know, I want to go back to the US. And I applied for scholarships and I got one to Southampton, Stony Brook. And so I came here.
How have you liked the East End? Is there any comparison to Europe with these little New England towns that we have here?
Yeah, I think there are. I mean, I think in the UK, Sussex is sort of like the Hamptons of Britain. You know, it's within drive from London, and the house is extremely expensive, but it's really a beautiful, physically beautiful area to live, and there's lots of great restaurants and shops. It's not an area I was familiar with as a child. I mean, I went to London maybe twice as a child, but London was shown to me by Americans. You know, they were like, look, this is Regent Street, this is German Street, this is Tower Row. I had no idea about any of this. So I'd say Sussex. And then I think in France, you've got, you know, where Yves Saint Laurent lived out in Normandy. So I think, there are these around major cities, there are these wonderful sort of rural areas.
Did you settle out here or talk about your family, your current family?
I actually wanted to settle out here, but I couldn't afford it. So I realized I'd have to go away like Heathcliff in Wuthering Heights and then come back, which is what I had to do. But now I have a wonderful wife, Christina, and she's an executive director of the biggest nonprofit media company in the country, actually, FYI. And I have a fantastic, brilliant daughter who's at SUNY New Paltz, and she's doing really well. And she's just a very interesting person, and I wouldn't have wanted anyone else as a daughter. She's really I just really admire her.
So you're living now in New York City, or where are you? I see this beautiful house. Where is this?
I'm in Springs at the moment, actually.
We're probably a few hundred yards from each other.
Yeah, it's Springs is sort of the unknown Hampton, but you know, it gets you out of bed in the morning when you think, oh, I'm in Springs, you know?
Yes, it's a beautiful day here. I live right on the harbor, on Three Mile Harbor.
Very nice.
Across the street from all the marinas. So it's very busy. It reminds me of Cassis in the old days. But you must have tried writing on a computer.
Yeah, I did for most of my time. I mean, I had an electric typewriter when I was, you know, in my 20s. And then, you know, because laptops, I found them to be quite noisy. I don't know if you have this experience, but sometimes just the fan will randomly come on and the fan is just whirring endlessly and it drove me nuts. So, and then during COVID, my eyes really suffered from just staring at the screen. So I went to the only typewriter shop left in New York City, and I bought an Olivetti, the one that, Cormac McCarthy uses, and that model. And I love it. I do all my first drafts on the typewriter now. But of course, my wife hates it because she's on a Zoom and all she can hear is pound, 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 pound.
So do you like to work outdoors, write outdoors or do you have a study?
No, I mean, I work in the bedroom, and I've experimented with, going out to offices or libraries, but I'm just more comfortable at really. Yeah. Well, I'm part of a club in London, and sometimes I go there to finish a book because it's nice and quiet.
Where is that?
It's the Royal Society of Medicine. I'm an EMT as well, because being behind a desk all day is really... I don't really like it very much. I like to be out using my hands. Like,
yeah.
If you need a fence putting up, anything, or like drywall, or just call me, Dan, because I like to keep busy, like wash the cars. Like I can't sit for too long. So being an EMT is great because I get to interact with people and care for them and hear their stories.
Where is this club?
Oh, the club in London, it's on Wimpole Street. And
oh, I see. So you're actually back and forth. If you're there, you're here.
Yeah.
I see.
Get out to me sometimes, get some sun.
How is this book that you're doing now different in some way from your earlier works?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. It's a good question. It is, because all my other works have sort of had flashbacks and they've gone back in time, maybe to World War II. you know, to where my, say, one book is about where my wife's grandfather was shot down over Nazi-occupied Belgium, and he was Jewish. So, you know, there was like, it was perilous for him, you know, parachuting in. And so that book, The Illusion of Separateness, which is set in Amagansett, and it's set in Nazi-occupied France, that book flashes back in time. But this book, Sipsworth, is the only novel I've ever written that is chronological. It's just 3 weeks, and it goes from Friday to Friday, 3 weeks, no flashbacks, two main characters, that's it.
How else is it different? Is that easier? Did you find it difficult to do that without flashbacks?
Yeah, it's much harder. I found it more difficult because the thing is, if the character or the place does something that is not in line with the narrative, then the spell is broken. But when you do flashbacks, of course, you know, you can go from Amagansett in 2010 to 1942 France, you know, because you're going back and forth, the seams act as sort of buffers. But when you are in one, pretty much a living room for 3 weeks with one human and one animal, anything out of place, like if the clock is not ticking the right way, or if 4 o'clock news doesn't come on at 4 o'clock, or if the kettle boils and she doesn't go to pour tea, it breaks the spell. So it's a lot harder because of the attention to detail you have to have in order for it to, because the reader is in the room.
Yeah, I know. I started there. She's in the garbage at one point at the beginning of the book, in the middle of the night, in fact.
Yeah.
After a rain. Are you working on anything new at this point?
Yeah, I'm working on something actually about set in Wales when I was a child, which, you know, I'm just exploring. I've got about 100 pages, but I'd like to say that, you know, when I first started writing, Dan, I focused on language, you know, because poetry was really my first love. And then I used to read Dan's papers. I mean, I have a copy here, the latest. I really love your stories. A lot of people don't know this, but you're actually a very talented writer. And I read a story, it must be 20 years ago, that you wrote about whale bones. So this is a story, right? And this is a testament to your skill, Dan, because I remember it 20 years later. Oh. So the story you wrote was that a whale washed up on the beach, and some people had the idea that they would take it for a circus and like show people and charge admission. But the thing is, they took it into the city, but it smelled so bad. They had to get rid of it. So they hired like the mob to transport the whale carcass, which had been hacked up by thugs in the middle of the night in Queens, to Staten Island, where it was, you know, if you have a body, everybody knows you take it to Staten Island. And they took it to Staten Island and they buried it. And then archaeologists, you know, in Staten Island found whale bones, which led them to realize that Staten Island at some point was underwater. So what I realized from, I loved that story, all those strange tales you used to write in Dan's papers. They were so entertaining, and I realized that good writing can't just be a skill with language. You have to have pacing, you have to have plot, you know, you have to sit next, it's like you have to sit next to somebody on a bus and you tell them blah blah blah, and they'll miss their stop to hear the end. And that's what your stories were like. So I thought to myself, I've got to learn what Dan's doing, I've got to learn this technique.
Did you call me at some point?
Yeah, I did. Okay. For anyone out here on the East End, I mean, your name is synonymous with media. So the fact that we're talking now is really a great thrill for me.
Well, I think I remember, I didn't remember, of course, you know, who called, but I remember telling you what I thought you might want to do. I'm glad you've done it.
You were very kind to me.
I think perhaps the main thing that's most important with all of this is that you found something you love to do, and you've become quite good at it. The works have been honored with awards, and so you're able to live a life that you enjoy in that regard. And I feel the same way about what I have done and still do.
Yeah.
So it's something I tried to pass down to my kids, and they I don't know whether they took it to heart or tried, or some of them are doing exactly what they want to do, which is kind of great. What do you like doing when you're out here in the Springs? What are some of the things that you enjoy?
I like being on the beach, running on the beach. I like sitting on a bench in Main Street and just waiting for somebody to come and start talking to me.
Yeah.
Just chatting with people in shops. I always go to LVIS. They have sort of like I wouldn't call it a thrift store, but it's sort of like, I like it because you sometimes, I don't know if you know about this shop.
Sure, you do. I know about the mansion that's next door to across the street from the Palm. That's what you're talking about?
Oh, no, I didn't know that. But they have a shop near the tennis courts in East Hampton, and it's sort of like a thrift store. And the mansion, yeah. And what's interesting is sometimes I'll see statues from, the 1700s in England, like Royal Staffordshire, or I'll see Meissen pottery. So over the years, like people who've lived out here, who've collected, just have exquisite taste, and they've collected all these things. So you'll go into this shop and you'll see a Savile Row tailored coat from the 1960s, or you'll see Meissen pottery. You just never know. Or you'll see like an East Hampton t-shirt from 1975.
What?
First edition, Colson Whitehead signed. It really is, because so many interesting people and successful people live out here.
Yes.
It's really a wonderful little shop where you can, it's sort of like a little shop of treasures. I'm sure Stephen King would find something horrible happen there, but it's quite nice.
Well, thank you for being on the podcast.
Thanks, Dan. I'm really honored to speak to you. And thanks for your service to media over the last few decades.
What street are you living on? Where are you? How far from me are you?
I'm on Newton Lane?
Yeah, Newtown Lane, yeah. In town.
I'm actually cat sitting for friends of mine. I'm on Fairway Drive.
At the moment, but where I'm at, where do you live?
I live in Williamsburg in Brooklyn.
Oh, that too.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. And again, thank you very much.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Bye.